Hit something up here. Okay, got it. It's good to be here with you this morning. I appreciate the invitation to speak to you. I really appreciate the fact that I wasn't asked to teach the Romans 5 class. That's why Adonis gets paid the big bucks. So, anyway, it's good to see all of you here. Leithy and I came up here. We didn't visit here, but about 2 years ago we came up to Kansas City for Linda and Mac's 50th anniversary. And it occurred to me then, I have been coming up to this place for 50 years. I've known many of you for half a century. And boy, some of you have really aged. I've scarcely aged a bit. But it's good to see all of you, know so many of you through the years, and really appreciate all of you. There's a word we use in our language. It's in our language. We don't use it much anymore. It's the word dogged. The word dogged has different definitions, but basically it's having or showing tenacity and grim persistence. That's the Google Dictionary. Marked by stubborn determination. That's Merriam-Webster. Persistent in effort, stubbornly tenacious is dictionary.com. A person who is dogged in something, it means they don't take no for an answer. They're going to pursue something until they get a particular result. And I want this morning to look at a particular person in the New Testament who exhibited what I call a dogged faith. It's the woman we just read about in Matthew chapter 15, verses 21 through 28. So if you have your Bibles, turn there, and that's the text that we'll be looking at. This particular story at the end or near the end of Matthew chapter 15 occurs. It occurs in two places. It's in Matthew 15, and then also the parallel text is in Mark chapter 7, verses 24 through 30. In both places, it occurs after the discussion about tradition that we read about in the first half of Matthew chapter 15. And there, it's clear that Jesus had absolutely no use for the kinds of distinctions that the scribes and the Pharisees made. They had all kinds of distinctions about what was clean and unclean, and Jesus would have none of that. And I think this story illustrates another kind of distinction that Jesus quit making. He quit making distinctions between people. The Pharisees and the scribes would have been perfectly happy to label people as clean or unclean. In fact, if you were connected, if you lived where the scribes and the Pharisees did, if you had a family member that they thought was unclean, they wouldn't associate with you either, because their uncleanness had rubbed off on you. And what Jesus does in this story, he associates with someone that the Pharisees and the scribes would have said, they're just unclean, they're not worthy of our attention. So Jesus would have none of that stuff, and I think that's really the setting of this particular story. We're told in Matthew chapter 15, verse 21, Jesus went away from there and withdrew into the district of Tyre and Sidon. That little geographic note, the last place that we read about in Matthew's gospel is back in chapter 14, verse 34. They had been on the east side or maybe the northeast part of the Sea of Galilee. And chapter 14, verse 34 says they land at Gennesaret. Gennesaret was a town on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. So everything that happens at the end of chapter 14 and in chapter 15 up through verse 21 happens in Gennesaret. And we're told that he leaves there. He went away from there, withdrew. And that word withdrew, I think, is significant. Jesus wanted a break. He wanted a break from the scribes and the Pharisees. He wanted a break from this heavy burden that he's been carrying. Mark's account says that he went there seeking solitude. He wanted to be by himself. So he wants to get away from this. And I think there was a strategy to what he did. That choice of geography was significant. For one thing, Gennesaret was located in the province of Galilee, the Roman province of Galilee, which was predominantly Jewish. By going up to Tyre and Sidon, he was going to a different Roman province where there would have been, where Jews were in the minority. And he was pretty sure that the scribes and Pharisees wouldn't follow him there. They wanted to stay in their own clean territory. So I think there is some significance to why Jesus chose to go to this particular place. And We're told that he's seeking privacy. Mark's account tells us that. Mark's account also says that he was in a house when this particular story takes place. I think that has some significance too. He's probably staying with someone. He's probably staying with a patron, someone who probably financed his trip up there, someone who gave him a place to stay. Him and his apostles are with him too, so they're taking on quite a few people when they arrive here in Tyre and Sidon. And that's where we're introduced to this woman. The setup is verse 21 and then verse 22. And the first part of the verse, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and began to cry out. We're told several things about her. First of all, we're given some barriers here in verse 21 and 22. The Jews would have considered her to be a foreigner. Now, never mind they're on her home turf, but as far as the Jews were concerned, she was a foreigner. Mark's account actually describes her differently. Matthew says she's a Canaanite woman. Mark's account, if you go over there and look, excuse me. I get all choked up sometimes. Just came out of nowhere. Anyway, Mark's account tells us, first of all, she's a Syrian. Geographically, that's where she lived. It was the Roman province of Syria. Ethnically, she was Phoenician. Now, some translations say she was Syro-Phoenician. Phoenician meant that she was descended from the Phoenicians who lived in Tyre and Sidon for many, 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 many centuries. And then we're also told culturally she was a Greek. That's what Mark's account says. Now, the New American Standard, which is what I'm reading from, says that she was a Gentile. The term that's used there is Hellenist. She was a Hellenist. She was Greek culturally. She spoke the Greek language. She was probably a citizen of that area. Matthew uses a different term, though. When you look at Matthew's account, he tells us in verse 22 that she was a Canaanite. So that's a spiritual referent. Spiritually, she was a Canaanite. She was descended from the perpetual enemies of the Israelites. When the Israelites took over the land of Canaan, the promised land was full of these Canaanites, the seven nations that they weren't supposed to associate with. That's who she was descended from. Spiritually, she was the enemy of Jesus and his apostles, or had been for many, many centuries. And that didn't really matter to Jesus. He goes to this place which had once been Canaanite territory. So those are the barriers. She is a foreigner, she is a Canaanite, and she was a woman. Remember the story in John chapter 4 of Jesus and the Samaritan woman. She was not only surprised that a Jew would have any dealings with Samaritans, she was surprised that a Jewish male and a Jewish male rabbi would actually be talking to a woman and talking to her in a public setting. That just wasn't done in ancient times. And so she's got several barriers. She's a foreigner, she's a Canaanite, and she is a woman. In other words, to the Jews, to people like Jesus' disciples, Jesus' apostles, she was nobody. She was nobody. She was lower than nobody. And that's the setup here. They go to this place, and this nobody woman comes up and starts talking to Jesus. Now, you get a sense of the urgency of the situation in the second part of verse 22. She came from that region. She came out and began to cry out. Now, remember, Mark's account says she's in a house. Now, literally, the phrase that's used down in verse 23, the disciples said, send her away because she keeps shouting at us. That phrase, at us, literally means behind us. So it could be that she's chasing them down. It could be that they are in the house and she's outside behind where they are yelling. Have you ever sat down for lunch and somebody starts yelling at you from the outside of your house? How rude. How rude of her. Or it may be, and I think this is actually the case, it may be she just walked into the house. Now, back in ancient times, if you had a big enough house to entertain at least 13 people, the apostles and Jesus, if you had a house big enough to do that, you probably had more of a compound. You had a large house with at least one room big enough for a nice feast or a nice gathering. And you probably was fenced off with a courtyard. You could go in, people came and went in the courtyard all day long. So it's possible that she just walked in. She heard that Jesus is there. She walks in to this house and starts. She doesn't politely say, could you send message to Jesus and maybe he and I could have a little bit of alone time? I just got something to talk to him about. No, that's not it at all. She began to cry out, saying, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed." Here is a foreign woman, a Canaanite, and the first thing I get from her is she is crying out. And the verb that's used there means that she kept crying out. She didn't just text somebody. She didn't just send a handwritten note. She's standing nearby crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me." And she kept doing it. And do you think that was distracting? It was intended to be distracting. And so she keeps crying out over and over. And the disciples say in verse 23, "Send her away. She keeps shouting at us." And that's present tense verb. From their perspective, the lady wouldn't shut up. She keeps doing this over and over. She also recognizes Jesus not only as Lord. The next thing I notice is she recognizes Jesus as Lord. She's a foreigner. She is a woman. She is a Canaanite. And she recognizes the authority that Jesus has. If anybody could solve her problem, it would have to be Jesus. And not only that, and this is an ironic twist. Now, Matthew's gospel emphasizes the connection that Jesus has with David. He is descended from David. Here is a Canaanite woman, a foreign woman, a non-Jew who recognizes that. Now, all through Matthew's gospel, we keep running into people who are Jews who will not recognize that. But here is this Canaanite woman who recognizes he is the son of David. He is descended from King David. Here is the future David. Here is the future Messiah. If anybody can solve her problem, Jesus, Lord, Son of David, can do that. And then we see why she is in such a kerfuffle about this in the last thing in verse 21. Why is she crying for mercy? "Because my daughter is cruelly demon-possessed." Now, Mark's account uses a different word for daughter. It uses a diminutive form of this, which means my little daughter, her little girl. Now, if you're a parent, you understand if you have little children, if they get bad sick, you get worried. You really get worried. I read something recently. It's, you know, with your first child, if your first child swallows a quarter or something like that, you take them to the hospital and you're all worried about it and you want the doctor to see them and you want x-rays and you want follow-up visits. By the time you get to the third child, you just say, you swallowed a quarter. I'm taking that out of your allowance. But anyway, this was her little girl, and it wasn't just an owie. This was something severe. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed. If you want to know what that looks like at a practical level, turn to Mark 9. Mark chapter 9 records a reference of someone who was demon-possessed. They had a child who was demon-possessed. Mark chapter 9. In verse 17, one of the crowd, "Teacher, I brought you my son possessed with a spirit which makes him mute." So at least with some, they could not speak. Verse 18, "Whenever it seizes him," this is Mark 9:18, "whenever it seizes him, it slams him to the ground and he foams at the mouth and grinds his teeth and stiffens out. I told your disciples to cast it out and they could not do it." It sounds like epilepsy, but it was far worse than that. Keep reading, verse 20. "They brought the boy to him. When he saw him," and this is the demons at work, "immediately the spirit threw him into a convulsion, and falling to the ground, he began rolling around and foaming at the mouth." And then in verse 22, the father continues to explain, "It has often thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. If you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." And in verse 25, in verse 26, "After crying out and throwing him into terrible convulsions, it came out, and the boy became so much like a corpse that most of them said he is dead. That's what demon possession looked like. And can you imagine it if your child was in that condition? And this boy had been that way since childhood, is what the text indicates. So here is a woman who has an urgent need for Jesus, which probably explains another thing, her persistence, her doggedness. She would not take no for an answer. So you look at verse 23, she comes up, she begins to cry out. He did not answer her a word. So the first thing, this woman comes to him, he just says nothing. He just says nothing. Have you ever gotten the silent treatment from someone? You go up, you ask a question. Have you ever been in a fast food place and you walk up and you're standing at the counter and you're thinking, well, maybe they would like to serve me food. And there's eight people behind the counter and they look at you and they say nothing. Isn't that your kind of restaurant? Or have you ever gone to an office or a bank and you got a problem and it seems like nobody cares about your problem? Nothing makes me angrier than the silent treatment. Nothing frustrates me more than the silent treatment. I got a problem and nobody wants to help. And in this case, she comes to Jesus, Lord, Son of David, and he says nothing. We'll talk a little bit more about why he does this in a moment. But Jesus doesn't say anything to her. And not only that, he was silent. She keeps crying out. He answered her not a word. And the disciples came. The disciples came. And they said, send her away because she keeps shouting at us. The disciples came and implored him. She is imploring him for one thing. They are imploring him for another. She's imploring him because she wants him to heal her daughter. They are imploring him, just get rid of the lady. And I don't think they mean heal her and send her on her way rejoicing. No. Just get rid of her. She is a nuisance. She's bothering our meal. How rude of her. And she persists. She keeps crying out. She keeps crying out. And they recognize that. She's not going to let up. And then we see something about her worship of Jesus, verse 24 and 25. Instead, the second time, verse 24, Jesus answers and says, I was sent only to the lost house of the sheep of Israel. Now, to put that kind of in a modern context, maybe you've had this happen. Something happens at your house, something happens with your car, and you call your insurance agent and say, look, I need to file a claim. They say, well, let me check this, and they look at your policy. I'm sorry, that's not covered. I'm sorry, lady, you're not an Israelite, and I came to help the house of Israel. I'm sorry, you're not covered. You're not covered by this policy. So first, Jesus ignores her. And then he says, I'm sorry, you're right, you're not the right ethnicity. Can't help you. Can't help you. And so she came and began to bow down. She came and worshiped the man who said, I'm sorry, I can't help you. You're the wrong religion, lady. And she comes down and she worships. It's one thing. I've known people who they talk about Lord Jesus all the time, but when it comes right down to it, they will never acknowledge him as Lord. They talk about it. This lady called him Lord, called him Son of David, pleaded with him, and when he ostensibly sent her away, he doesn't technically send her away, he just gives her first the non-answer, and then another answer, which means, well, you know, I came to help Israelites. And at that point, she just barges past the disciples. If you play quarterback, how would you like a front line like that? A woman got past them. A woman got past them. She just barges right past them, and it says, She came and bowed down before him. And Mark says basically the same thing. Mark says she fell at his feet. She began to worship him. The man who actually put a barrier in front of her, she comes and she worships him. You know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of the situation with Daniel and his three friends when they were about to be cast into the fiery furnace. And they said, Lord, and they told Nebuchadnezzar, look, anything you do to us just doesn't matter to us. Our God is able to deliver us from the fire. And even if he doesn't, that's okay. We're not going to bow to you. She is going to seek Jesus no matter what because he is Lord. And even if he refuses her request, Jesus was still her Lord. And she was willing to come and bow down before him to acknowledge that. So in verse 24 and 25, she just ratchets it up. She cries out, she won't be denied, and she worships Jesus. And then Jesus, this conversation takes the most, this has got to be maybe the most bizarre incident in the Gospels. And we need to read it for what it is. Jesus throws an insult at her. He answered, she bowed down before him, Lord, help me. And he answered, it is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Jesus called her a dog. You know, it's like you go up and you meet someone. Oh, you're related to them. You're not nearly as ugly as they are. Wow, consolation, I suppose. Jesus calls her a dog. Now, technically, there are two different words in the New Testament for dog. Over in Philippians chapter 3, when Paul said, beware the dogs, the word that's used there was a word that described curs, stray animals out on the street, vicious dogs, dogs that would bite you. In fact, in ancient Greek, that word in Philippians 3 would be used to describe male prostitutes. It was an ugly, ugly word. This is a diminutive form of that, and what it means is a lap dog, a little dog, a tiny dog. The kind you have, you know those annoying people that take those little pets into Walmart with them and you see their heads sticking up out of their purse? That kind of dog is what I'm talking about. I don't care if she called him a little, if he called her a little dog or not. He called her a dog. He called her a dog. Now, what he's doing is he's playing on how Jews typically looked at Gentiles. Jews called Gentiles dogs. That's what they felt about them. And Jesus uses that phrase. And you want to know how humble this woman was? Look at her answer to that. Yes, Lord, but. Yes, you're right. I'm not a Jew. Yes, you're right. I'm a woman. I'm a foreigner. I'm all of that. But Lord, yes, Lord. She still calls him Lord. She still acknowledges Jesus as Lord. Yes, I realize I'm not an Israelite. I know how your people think about me. But even the dogs feed on the crumbs which fall from their master's table. Maybe I'm a dog, but even dogs get crumbs. She had enough humility to say, yes, maybe I am a dog. Maybe I am. What was Jesus doing here? Some have tried to suggest that maybe he was just kind of joking with her. Maybe he had a smile on his face and a twinkle in his eye. I don't see that. The gospel doesn't record any emotion by Jesus in this text. I think Jesus laid it on her. Why? Why would he do that? There's a lot of reasons that I could probably give. I'm going to give you my opinion about it. I think he was testing two people, two groups of people. First, I think he was testing her. He wanted to find out how badly she wanted this. I think it was a test to her. And this is not the first time Jesus does this. Jesus frequently tested people. He tested his own disciples. Earlier at the feeding of the 5,000, He looks at these 5,000 men plus all the women and the children. There's probably 10, 12, 15,000 people there on that occasion. And he turns to his disciples. He turns to the apostles and said, and by the way, they had already been given, when they became apostles, they were anointed with the power to heal and perform miracles. And he turned to the apostles and he said, so what are we going to do? And it went right over their heads. They were clueless. I don't know. I got a few denarii here, and there's a quick trip down the street, and we can probably run down there and get a few sandwiches, but I don't think that's going to be enough. They failed the test miserably. But Jesus often tested people. I think he's testing her. But I'll tell you who else I think he's testing. I think he's testing his disciples. When this woman first comes, they want to get rid of her. And I think Jesus wanted them to see, do you know what you guys look like? Here is a woman whose child is sick and you want to run her off? You want this dog to go away? And he calls this woman a dog. I think he was testing his disciples. Do you see how prejudiced you are? Do you see what kind of spirit you have? And this isn't the only time. Remember in Luke chapter 9 when Jesus sets his face toward Jerusalem, at one point they pass through Samaria and the Samaritans would not let them stay with them. And James and John, the apostle of love, he says, Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven and burn these people to a crisp? He said, you don't know what kind of spirit you are. I think Jesus did this to test some people. To test her, and I think to test his disciples as well. And then the payoff comes, though, in verse 28. She throws it right back at Jesus and says, yeah, I may be a dog, but even dogs get crumbs. And then Jesus said to her, O woman, your faith is great. It shall be done for you as you wish. And her daughter was healed at once. Before she even got back, Jesus did a long-distance healing. And I think what's remarkable is he says, O woman, your faith is great. Remember, just in the very next chapter, Peter will confess that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And Jesus commends him for that. There are two other people in Matthew's gospel that got commended for their faith prior to that. Both of them were Gentiles. Both of them were Gentiles. A man in Matthew chapter 8 and this woman in Matthew chapter 15. Jesus commended her faith. It was her faith that saved her and her daughter. This to me is one of the most amazing stories in all the Gospels. And as I said, when I get down to verse 26 and 27, I cringe every time. It's not that I don't think Jesus knew what he was doing. He did. It still hurts, though. But Jesus often did things that surprise us. Jesus did things that surprised his disciples, that surprised his apostles, and surprised his enemies. And I think that's what we have here. I want to talk about just a few lessons for us. First point I want to make is, sometimes we're a lot like the disciples, and we think we need to run interference for Jesus. Let's keep the riffraff away. I remember years ago, I heard a lady say, she said, well, we got to be careful who we let into the church. She was concerned about worldliness, and we don't want worldly people in the church. Well, I'm sorry, but if you exclude worldly people from coming into the church, you ain't got many customers left. Don't have many prospects left. Maybe we're not aware of it. Maybe we've forgotten this. But the church is not made up of people who started out as saints. The church is made up of people who are sinners. It's a clinic for the spiritually sick wherein the good physician tries to heal them. And if we exclude sinners from the church, we ain't got nobody left. We got no one left. I'm sure that the disciples thought they were running, you know, we're helping Jesus. After all, he came, he withdrew to Tyre and Sidon. He needed a rest. He didn't want to be bothered by anyone. So let's protect Jesus. That's not our job. Jesus can take care of himself. Many years ago, we were in a congregation, and there was a young man who had been bringing his girlfriend to church. They met, they had classes together at school, knew each other from school, and so he brought her to a church. And her parents had a bad marriage. They were trying to get a divorce. They just couldn't afford to. So you can imagine what kind of household that was. Her mother had been a member of the church many, many years before, but had pretty much nothing to show for it. The mother really encouraged this young lady to dress like a teenager. And after she had come with this boy a few times to church, she noticed that all the girls at church wore dresses. So one time she showed up at church in a dress, a very short dress, a plunging neckline dress, a very tight dress. And he brought her to church. After church was over, there was one elderly woman there who came up after services, and this girl wasn't a Christian. She wasn't a member of that congregation. She came up and got about 10 feet from the girl and just said loud enough for probably about 20 or 30 people to hear her, "Well, I wonder if anybody's ever taught this young lady how she ought to dress when she comes to church." Then that was it. Didn't say hello. Didn't say, "I am so glad to see you." Didn't say, "I am so glad you have been visiting us for as long as you have. I really appreciate that." No, just made a comment about the clothing of a visitor. And we do things. Now, this girl, yes, Lord, but. She kept coming back. She eventually was converted. She's still faithful as far as I know today. We wonder sometimes why we struggle converting people. I got a few hints. Somebody comes into our assembly, they don't look like us, they don't dress like us, they don't smell like us, they don't talk like us, and we glare at them, and we don't come up and warmly greet them, and we wonder why nobody wants the gospel. They have hatred and prejudice and animosity in the world. And if they come to the kingdom and see the same thing, why should they care? And we're going to answer to God for that. We're going to answer to God for that. The least we can do is go up and say, "Hello, I'm glad you're here." The least we can do. And that's the kind of love that we need to do. And I think this affects our evangelism too. We try to run interference. We try to find good prospects. We try to weed out the bad prospects. What we think is the ideal candidate for evangelism is someone who enthusiastically goes to another church, and let's just bring them in and clean them up and sanitize them and teach them about the one true church. And we don't want to have to deal with problems. We don't like talking with gays and lesbians. We are entirely uncomfortable talking to transgenders. We don't like talking to atheists. We don't like talking to liberals. And boy, if we ever have to talk to a Democrat. And we can be so utterly judgmental toward anybody and everybody. The Lord is not under any obligation whatsoever to send us any visitors. We need to quit running interference for Jesus and talk to anybody that will listen, anyone who will listen. Because Jesus is Lord and His gospel saves. That's why. There's another lesson here, and that is, like the woman, do we have real humility? Imagine today, if somebody had come up to a well-known evangelist. I'm just going to use Rick Warren. You know, everybody knows who Rick Warren is. He said, "Teach me the gospel." He said, "I'm sorry, I don't teach dogs. I'm sorry, you're a woman. I can't have this conversation." Can you imagine the outrage? I mean, people be whipping out their phones and posting it on Facebook and YouTube and everything else. He called her a dog. And she said, "Yes, maybe I am." Your humility determines whether or not you'll obey the gospel. I've had conversations where you try to tell people about their sins. "Well, I'm not that bad a person." Well, You're lost. Is that bad enough? You call someone a sinner. That's outrageous. You know what these people's problem is? They have no humility. This woman wanted it so badly, she acknowledged that, yes, I'm not an Israelite. Yes, I know how you look at me. But, and she kept coming after him, and she kept coming after him. We need that kind of humility. In the last year and a half with the COVID stuff, I get sick to death of the outrage on Facebook. Someone had me wear a mask. I'm outraged. Someone wants me to get a shot. I'm outraged. Someone has a different view of COVID than I do. I'm outraged. And throw in the elections, and we're all just outraged. We're mad about everything. And we think, do we actually think that's going to win points with people who are not Christians? Peter said in 1 Peter 3, verse 15, "But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always ready to make a defense to anyone who asks you for an account of the hope that lies within you." And that's where we stop the verse. Oh, I'm defending the faith. And the last phrase that Peter uses, with gentleness and reverence. Can you talk to someone you disagree with gentleness? Can you demonstrate to them that you absolutely care about their soul and not resort to sarcasm, not resort to put-downs, not resort to just the ugliest strands of communication that we can muster? And that's what I get so sick of on Facebook, and I get sick of Christians posturing on Facebook. If that's what Christianity is, and if I'm an atheist, I want nothing to do with that. Can we not show the reverence and the love and the humility that Jesus Christ had? It has never occurred to some of us that we might actually be wrong about some things. I remember Oliver Cromwell's famous statement to the Church of, to the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland in 1650. He said, "I beseech you by the bowels of Christ, think it possible that you may be wrong." Has it ever occurred to us that maybe we need to change our approach to things? This woman was humble, and that's why she was interested in Jesus. Like this woman, do we hunger and thirst for righteousness? Will you let anything get in the way of your relationship to Christ? And you hear people, "Well, I wasn't at church Sunday because I had a headache." And yet Monday they still have the headache, but they go to work. I don't understand that. You'll work 8 hours with a headache, but you won't sit in a padded pew in a climate-controlled environment and feed on the Word of God for an hour or maybe two. The excuses that keep us away from church, the excuses that keep us from serving God. "Well, I would teach a class, but..." and just fill in the blank with whatever excuse you want to give. But if the employer asks us to do something, if the coach asks us to do something, oh, we will do whatever is required. And what it reveals is we do not really hunger for God. We will let anything stand in the way of our relationship to Christ. This woman had dogged faith, and nothing was going to get between her and God. Nothing would get between her and God. And sort of as an extension of that, is her persistence. I think the attitude of hungering and thirsting led to the action of persistence. She would not give up. She would not give up in her faith. We need to apply that to prayer. You know, Jesus talked about persistence in prayer. And what he did not mean is that if you pester God enough, that he'll give you your way. I think Jesus sometimes is silent, like he was in this story. He just said nothing. Let's just see how bad she wants it. Often we pray about things and there is this thunderous silence from heaven. We pray, and we pray, and there's no answer. Okay, keep praying. How badly do you want it? This was a test of this woman. And sometimes God's silence, sometimes God's non-answers, he just wants to know how badly we want it. It's not that he's not willing to give. It's not that he's a miser. It's not that he's waiting to crack his celestial bullwhip. He just wants to know, do you really want it? Do you really want it? Do you really want a relationship with God through Christ? It's there. You can have it. He just wants to know how badly you want it. And in an age where we are so distracted by so many things, there's one thing that's important, and that is Jesus Christ. If you're here this morning and you've never obeyed Jesus as Lord, this is the opportunity to do what this woman did. Heard Matt Basford, read an article by Matt Basford recently. He said, we need to go after God like a bill collector. This woman went after God like a bill collector. She would not wait until she got it, would not go away. If you've never obeyed Jesus as Lord, that's the kind of persistence he wants. And for those of us who are Christians, maybe we lag sometimes in our persistence. If that's the case, we need to redouble our efforts. If we can help you in any way this morning, we invite you to come forward while we stand and sing.
Have thine own way.